Chapter 2. Thank you for your recent payment. The outstanding estate of the late Hidu Rezodar has now been released by the Registry of Testaments and Legacies, and you may collect the items any time in the next 10 days. Now the claim process has been activated, any item not removed by that time will be auctioned by the State of Feda, and you will forfeit all ownership. Any taxes or duties payable on the items must be settled before leaving the planet. Message from the Faden State Treasury to Boba Fett, Mandalore, Alori Ramikade, leader of the Mandalorian clans, commander of super commandos. Bralsin, near Keldabe, Mandalore. The weathered helmet of Fen Shisa still stood on a granite column in the clearing, firmly secured by a durasteel peg. Only animals or storms would have dislodged it. Nobody would have thought of stealing the relic of a much-loved Mandalore. It had even survived the Yuuzhan Vong's attempt to devastate the planet. Shisa was revered.
"Been a long time, Shisa."
Boba Fett didn't make a habit of talking to dead men, except his father. It was the first time he'd visited the site.
"You got your way."
The helmet had once been vivid green with a red T-section, but the paint had dulled to browner tones, and the scrapes and dents of battle were more visible. The memorial was a substitute for a proper Mandalore's grave. Shisa's body was still in the Quince sector where Fett had left it. The helmet was all he'd brought back. It was an apt memorial for a populist leader, to be commemorated in the same way as any ordinary Mandalorian. Only the Mandalore, the head of state of a stateless people, was buried. Their nomadic warrior culture had no tradition of orderly cemeteries.
"Where will they bury me, if I have any say in it, when the end really comes? I'll just set Slave One on autopilot for the Outer Rim and keep going."
Fett had been an absentee Mandalore, ignorant of his own people's traditions. His lessons, whether he wanted them or not, came from his newfound granddaughter Myrta, who insisted on calling him Babuir, grandfather, and encouraging him to embrace his heritage. Relations between the two of them were tepid. That was a big improvement. They'd started out as homicidal. He stared at Shisa's helmet, remembering.
"The crazy Barv. Was I worth it? You'd only say I told you so. So save your breath."
"I can't wait for you any longer."
The sudden voice in his helmet's audio link made him jump, but it was just Myrta. She was itching to get underway for Feda.
"You'll wait," he said. "You've waited 3 months. You can wait 10 minutes more."
Fett tapped 2 fingers to his helmet in a farewell salute to Shisa, and swung back onto the speeder bike.
"If you only look after your own hide, then you're not a man."
That was just about the last thing Shisa ever said to him before he died. Fett set off for Goron Bevine's farm, skimming above the silver ribbon of a tributary that flowed into the Kalita River. The landscape was changing. Since he'd first returned to a planet still struggling back to life after the Yuuzhan Vong had done their best to kill it, Mandalorians scattered around the galaxy had started coming home, thousands of them, and then hundreds of thousands and more. The land was recovering. Farming was beginning again on tracts salted and poisoned by the Vongese. It gave him a good feeling. Mondo Ade showed their defiant streak by getting old farms thriving again rather than find new, easier land to cultivate. No, the Crab Boys, as Bevin still called the Yuuzhan Vong, hadn't won. Myrta was a persistent girl.
Babuir, you want me to start the drives?
No.
Are you okay?
Is Goron there?
She didn't need to know how he felt right then. He wasn't even sure himself, beyond a terrible, guilty dread.
Has he got the room ready?
Of course he has. Goron's never let you down.
That was true.
Is Belwine's accommodation sorted out?
Yes, but...
Then someone better tell him. The Oyubat is as five-star as we get in Keldabe.
You're psychic, Babuir.
Fett wasn't, but he knew his personal physician well enough to predict that he wouldn't think a room in the rustic Oyubat tapcalf good enough for a fancy Coruscant doctor.
Tough. I'm the customer.
If the ruler of Mandalore could put up with a rickety farm outhouse with brutally basic plumbing, the Oyubat was fine for Belwine. It was clean and warm. As long as he didn't try playing a round of Kubikod with the patrons, he'd be fine.
Tell him he can always be replaced by a med droid, he said.
When Fett banked the speeder around the last stand of trees, he could see Myrta leaning against the aft hull plates of Slave One, arms folded across her chest, and Goron Bevin waiting beside her in his slate-gray farm overalls.
No good acting like you don't care, Bevin said,
as Fett opened the cargo hatch from the remote on his forearm plate and steered the speeder onto the ramp.
You might have left her, but she's still your wife.
Fett secured the speeder.
Ex-wife.
The rooms and medroids are ready anyway.
Fett didn't mean to sound ungrateful. Bevin was a good man, Fett's chosen successor if anything went wrong, like death, like illness, like just plain old age. And he'd put up with a lot of demands since they'd located Sintas Vel's body. Fett's wife wasn't dead. Dead would have been hard after she'd been missing for more than 30 years. Dead would have been easier than finding her encased in carbonite, stored like junk among some dead gangster's forgotten possessions, and then working out what he'd say to her.
How do I tell her that our daughter Aelin's dead? How do I tell her everything that's happened since she went missing? That she's got a granddaughter.
At least Myrta could do her own telling. Fett released the hatch, and she climbed into the cockpit, a battered bag over one shoulder. She was in her mid-twenties, although she had a scrubbed look that made her look like a kid, and that meant she wouldn't be that much younger than her grandmother when she was revived.
But I don't know that. Sintas could have been captive for years, and only carbonited recently. She could be nearer my age. She was a few years older than me.
Either way, it was going to be a very hard reunion. The last time he saw her, he'd left her injured in an alley. It was an ignominious exit to add to abandoning her and their baby daughter. And now all the pain was going to come erupting to the surface again. All the memories he'd locked in his past, as surely as carboniting them, so he never had to look at them.
The medroids got full psychiatric programming too, Bobica, Bevin said quietly.
People usually came out of carbonite in a bad way. Anything from blind and disoriented to totally and permanently insane. She'd really thank him for that, if he only knew what her chances were.
Thanks, Goron, said Fett. Tell Medrit I'm grateful.
Ah, we've always got room for guests. Kiparjai, it's nothing.
Okay, Look after the shop while I'm gone.
The war between the Galactic Alliance and the Confederation was forgotten for the time being. Fett settled into the pilot seat and waited until he saw Bevine walk clear of the downdraft before he flicked the controls, and Slave One throbbed into life. The North Mandalorian countryside receded below into a patchwork, and the sky through the viewport darkened to violet and then black as they left the atmosphere. There was no going back now.
"What if she ends up insane?" asked Myrta.
"Han Solo was carbonited, and he's strutting around just fine."
"I'll look after her," she said.
"I can take care of her."
"Pay someone else to do it, you mean?"
So Myrta was in one of her combative moods today. That meant she was scared. He understood why, but he had his own problems to deal with when it came to facing Sintas again.
"How old was I when I walked out? 19? And then Myrta will want to drag up the reasons why I left. It's going to be rough." "Whatever," he said. "She'll be taken care of."
Fett wanted to blot the past out of his mind. He set course for Feda manually just to keep his hands busy, to stop thinking, and to avoid a conversation with Myrta. He even kept his helmet on in the cabin, his hint to her these days that he didn't want to talk. But it was never that easy to fend off her scrutiny. She seemed to hate gaps in a story, and for her, Fett had a lot more gaps than story in his life.
"Where did you go this morning?" she asked.
Not telling her would just stoke the fire. And maybe he wanted to give in to the interrogation now. Maybe it was time she knew, even though nobody else did. Maybe... did he want her to think better of him? Fett paused.
"She says memorial."
"Why?"
"Here we go. Hadn't been there since he died."
"Your brother said you deposed him."
"Brother?"
"Brother. Jang. Jang Skirata. That stanging smart-aleck clone who was still around all these years later."
"He's not my brother. We just share a genome, more or less. And I told him he didn't know what went on between me and Shisa."
"But you came back, and Shisa didn't."
"Long story."
"Got plenty of time. What happened?"
It gave Fett the occasional twinge of regret. It didn't haunt him, because he'd done what he had to do, and the alternative would have gnawed away even at his Durastial conscience. He debated whether to tell her, worried about his reasons for resurrecting another grim episode of his life at a time like this.
"I killed him,"
Fett said at last.
"I killed Fen Shisa."
Fleet HQ, Galactic City. Admiral Chani Othel could sense the mood of a ship, or shore establishment, the moment she stepped on board. And the mood of this one was shocked fear. It was impossible to keep some things quiet, and killing a junior officer on the bridge of the Anakin Solo was about as hard to hide as it got.
"It can't be true."
But the Anakin's captain, Kral Neville, a Quarren with a solid reputation both as a pilot and a commander, had witnessed it. He wasn't the only one who'd seen the incident. It wasn't just buzz, the fast-flowing river of gossip that circulated through both wardroom and lower deck throughout the fleet. Colonel Jason Solo, Joint Chief of State of the Galactic Alliance, had snapped Lieutenant Tebbutt's neck without even touching her on the bridge of his flagship in full view of the crew. The reason didn't matter. The enormity of the act made any reason irrelevant. The news had leaked. It would go around the fleet like a flash signal. Even the absolute loyalty of the Star Destroyer's rigorously vetted crew didn't stop talk about something that serious. Tebbutt had been loyal, too, they would say to one another, and look what had happened to her. It was just as well Neothel had reliable witnesses, because without them she would have dismissed it as wild rumor. Jason had done plenty of dirty things on his rise to power, but this wasn't just dirty, it was deranged.
"He's lost it. He's becoming a megalomaniac. What do I do now?"
She strode along the corridors of the HQ building toward the wardroom. On any other day, even in the middle of a war, the atmosphere in the building was busy and purposeful. The cumulative hum of voices had a certain pitch. If a ship had been lost in action, the hum dropped in volume and pitch, and the sorrow was tangible. But the pulse, the very heartbeat of the Navy, was still there. Today, the beating had stopped. The whole building seemed to be holding its breath, scared to exhale. When the Neothel passed personnel, they saluted automatically as normal, but they looked at her with expressions she could read all too well. "What's happening? How is he getting away with this? Surely you're going to do something about him." Those looks, mute pleas, were agonizing. But they weren't as bad as the ones that said, "You're Joint Chief of State. You're letting him do this." Neothel walked into the low rumbling of subdued conversation in the warrant officer's mess and hit a wall of sudden silence. Then everyone scrambled to snap to attention. She could taste the dread.
"At ease," she said,
and tried to act as if she was doing normal admiral's rounds to check on routine matters like tidiness and morale.
"Any complaints?"
"No, ma'am."
It was a chorus of voices. If anyone had raised the most obvious concern that the GA had a maniac at the helm, she would have had no answer. She couldn't take Jason on yet, and if she dismissed their worries, she would lose respect and trust.
"Nothing wrong with the food, ma'am."
Neothel nodded and carried on to her office. Captain Neville was waiting for her. She closed the doors and swept the room for bugs with her hand scanner, but even when it came up clean, she still whispered.
"All I can hope," she said,
not waiting for him to speak,
"is that when the news spreads, the crews believe it as much as I did, or think that poor woman deserved it for some reason. Because if they do reach the conclusion that he's a monster, morale will collapse and we've lost."
Neville didn't respond. The Quarren usually kept his counsel, but he seemed to be even more tight-lipped today.
"What is it, Captain? I've swept for surveillance devices. You can speak freely."
His mouth tentacles rippled as if he was measuring his words carefully.
"What are you going to do about Solo?"
Neothel's instinct and training said to call in the military police immediately, invoke emergency powers, and have Jason arrested. But her common sense said that Jason's loyal Galactic Alliance guard trumped the MPs, that the rest of the fleet was loyal to him, and that she would end up as sole chief of state, which, whatever she might have thought she wanted a couple of years ago, was now a poison chalice. And she was effectively Luke Skywalker's spy. She needed to stay on the inside to arm him with intelligence. Jason was too strong for her to confront and depose alone.
"For the moment, there's very little I can do," she said.
"Ma'am, you can put me on a charge for saying this if you like, but he needs to be relieved of duty."
"Do you trust me, Captain?"
Neville's tentacles became still. He was wary now.
I think I still do.
Then if I say that I'm as appalled by this monstrous act as you are, but that I have to make sure I'm actually in a position to do something conclusive, will you accept that without further explanation?
Neothel hoped he understood. If she told him more, he'd be compromised too. It was the oblique talk of coups and plots. Not that she was any stranger to that kind of coded conversation, having helped oust Cal Omis. Perhaps she was now getting her just deserts.
"I believe I get the general meaning, Admiral," said Neville.
Neothel wasn't sure he had.
"When you fire on a target like Jason Solo, you daren't miss or just wound him. You have to make sure he can't return fire. Ever."
Neville froze, then nodded. It was a human gesture, picked up from serving alongside humans, just as they adopted expressions from other species.
"I'd expected instant mutiny," he said. "But our tendency, all of us, is to maintain discipline and try to carry on as if nothing untoward is happening. As if that'll make it go away."
"There's a war on, Neville. Our people are too busy staying alive."
Neothel went to the window and looked out across the city, somehow expecting to see the view radically changed just as her world had been. But life went on. Coruscant was a long way from the front, and Jason was still the heroic colonel, crusher of terrorists, and son of two heroes of the old rebellion. Well-fed and defended, with distracting shows on the Holonet, the average Coruscant citizen wasn't about to rush to the barricades and storm the Senate, even if Tebbutt's fate was plastered all over HNE bulletins. It wouldn't be, of course.
"And it hasn't impacted the lives of civilians here. Yet."
Neville seemed a little more reassured that he was still talking to the officer and not the politician.
"I won't ask what you'll say to him when you meet. But he realizes you'll know, and you'll have to take some position on it."
"I shall openly question his methods, as I usually do," she said,
wondering if she had already confided too much in Neville.
"And he'll think nothing has changed."
"So you don't share a philosophy?"
"I'm disappointed that you might ever have thought I did."
Neville waited a couple of beats, as if to make his point, that he wasn't so sure an ambitious admiral wouldn't do whatever it took to achieve high office, including selling her honor.
"My son didn't die to put a sadistic despot in power," he said at last. "I look to you to ensure his life wasn't wasted."
It was a gut punch. Neothel wrote it.
"I'm sorry about Turl. I truly am."
Neville just inclined his head politely and left. Neothel had just had some of her worst fears confirmed. While she knew that she couldn't always be liked, and that becoming chief of state always meant treading on a few toes, she was wounded by not being trusted. Or believed. Ironically, the man who was so convinced he could end chaos and conflict with his shock tactics was sowing more of his own. Jason was making everyone wary and suspicious, even old friends and allies. She needed to broker a discreet meeting with Luke Skywalker. But first, she had to be true to form and confront Jason Solo indignantly about his latest lapse of judgment. She summoned her chauffeur. On the journey through the unconcerned, orderly skylanes of Coruscant to the Senate, she concentrated on being angry and indignant rather than working out her next covert moves. Jedi could sense these things. She thought of Neville's dead son, and the outrage came naturally. Coruscant really was very peaceful. It was hard to square what she saw from the speeder window with what was happening off-world on the battlefield, almost as if there were a portal she had passed through and back again into another dimension. But it hadn't been that long since the Yuuzhan Vong invasion. That had made the galactic capital much more nervous than planets that had suffered far worse and far more frequently over the centuries, and so it was willing to embrace Jason's extremes. Coruscant was scared and wanted to be protected. Neothel wondered how Jason would have fared trying to pull his hardline savior act on more battle-hardened, less innocent worlds. He was in his office, watching an intelligence holovid, a recording of a fleet engagement. There were so many brush fires breaking out across the galaxy now that she couldn't say where it was taking place without checking the images carefully to identify ships and terrain.
"Just another theater of war. The only positive thing I can see is that we've been saved from collapsing through overstretch by systems kind enough to stage their own local wars and excuse our attendance."
"What have I done this time?"
Jason said, not looking away from the screen.
"I could feel the little black cloud of reprimand coming."
"Stay angry. Don't let him sense anything beyond that."
Neothel took a deep breath, disguised as an exasperated human sigh.
"Jason, I know you're very new to the military, but here's a tip to help you fit into the culture of the wardroom. We don't kill junior officers on the bridge in front of everyone. It's bad form. At least try to do it somewhere less public in the future."
He looked up that time. She wondered if he was feeling the strain, because he looked more different by the day, a little older and less luminously youthful. It was especially noticeable in his eyes.
"Ah, word gets around."
She didn't sit down. She couldn't stay angry sitting down.
"Word gets around the fleet. And fast. You're a fool."
"Really? I thought I was doing quite well."
"Morale, Jason. It's an asset every bit as much as a Star Destroyer. We ask those we command to be ready to die for us, not because of us. And the moment we lose their confidence, we start to lose the war. We need them."
"Oh, and they need me."
He let out a snort of contempt.
"The pact works both ways. Tebbutt was careless. It's not an exercise, Admiral. It's a real war, and mistakes get you killed. We could have lost the war thanks to Tebbutt. I think what happened to her brought home to everyone what that means."
"Did you mean to make an example of her? Or did you just lose control and it all got out of hand?"
That got a reaction, all right. She watched his eyes flicker, but not a muscle on his face moved for a second or two.
"I think we'll see an improvement in security procedures after this."
"Good," she said. "Ah, he's either worried he'll burn out, or he's already snapped and he doesn't want me to know he's falling apart. I'll spend some of my very limited time repairing the damage you've done to morale, then. Because if a ship's company is terrified of getting something wrong, pretty soon they stop using their initiative and don't do anything at all. Do I need to explain?"
"You care too much about being popular."
Neothel had to bite back a retort. She knew her reputation on the mess decks as a humorless iceberg.
Yes. I must keep my party girl image in check.
Anyway, Fondor, time to pick them off.
I would prefer to hit their industrial capacity first, shut down their shipyards.
We need those assets in one piece.
If we want them as a going concern, then we'll probably have to occupy the planet to enforce that, because the government isn't about to capitulate, and we don't have the resources to do it.
We might.
Oh, do share.
The Imperial Remnant. I'm opening negotiations.
How good of you to involve me in this.
I haven't committed us to anything.
So it's us again. If you think Pelion is going to kiss and make up after I took his job, you're really not paying attention.
Well, just to give the Moffs an incentive to persuade him to forgive and forget, I was thinking of offering them some extra turf in return for joining us. Borlias and Dilbringi.
It was certainly an incentive, and would have been excessively generous if either world had been the GA's gift to give. Neither was a full member of the Alliance.
So what does the gift amount to? Turning a blind eye to the Moffs invading? Helping them do it? Helping them costs resources. And we'd never have gone to their aid had those planets been attacked anyway. So how do we give?
When we defeat the Confederation, we'll shape the galaxy as we see fit for the greatest benefit. They contribute to that, and they get two rich worlds for their trouble.
Or they still get two worlds that don't want to be under their yoke and fight them for every meter of land.
Either way, not our problem.
But sooner or later, it would come back to bite him, she was sure.
This reminds me of one of those Naboo timeshare scams, she said.
It was time to let him get bitten, and Pelion would never allow it anyway.
But I leave the high-level politics to you.
Fondor, then?
Shut down their shipyards first, because that disables their war effort. Then we neutralize their armed forces.
Very well.
And are you going to talk to Pelion direct?
I was thinking of sending a more neutral figure. Tahiri.
Jason. She's not exactly a diplomat, or even a negotiator.
All she has to do is get him to accept the principle. I can do the rest.
Neothel got the feeling that Tahiri was being groomed to take Ben's place. She was glad the boy had managed to get out of Jason's grip. He had the makings of a good officer and was becoming his own man.
Let me know when you do, then.
She turned to go to her own office, the one she'd had as Supreme Commander. It felt like a haven at times like this.
Preferably before you take action.
Send Shevu in, will you? Jason called after her. He should be outside by now.
Neothel passed the young GAG captain in the corridor, right on time, and gave him a nod toward Jason's door. He didn't look happy, but he didn't look scared. If Jason tolerated someone that visibly unintimidated in his entourage, then Shevu had to be one of his most trusted lackeys. She would keep her distance.
He's all yours, said Neothel.
The Millennium Falcon, Jedi Outpost, Endor.
So, Dad, how do I contact Boba Fett?
Jaina asked. All she could see of Han Solo in his position under the coolant lines of the Millennium Falcon were his pilot's boots.
How did you get hold of him?
Usual way, kid. I stood around like a jerk, and he ambushed me.
I'm serious, Dad.
Han hauled himself out from under the Falcon and got to his feet.
This is Jag's idea, isn't it? I should never have let him have the crush gaunts.
Hey, I can make my own crazy decisions. And the best person to teach me how to hunt Jedi is Fett. Am I right?
Han wiped the Hydra's banner on a rag, and Jaina could see that a light had gone out of him. Beyond the clearing, the forest was a cacophony of wild noise that somehow managed to coalesce into something tranquil. Here she was, talking in this detached and oblique way about hunting Jedi, her twin brother, her father's only remaining son. There were days when Dad disowned Jason and never wanted to see him again. And the next day? The next, Jason was his boy again, and he wanted to look after him and put things right. But every day the volume of things that needed putting right got bigger and harder and more impossible. Dad hurt. Jaina knew Mom was hurting too, but she seemed to be handling it better than him.
So Ben thinks Jason killed Mara.
Jaina reached out and took the rag and the tool from his hands.
It's clean now, Dad. Yes, he does.
What do you think?
I don't know. I just don't know.
You think he's capable of that?
I don't even want to think about it yet.
Jaina, do you think he's capable of it?
Jason had tortured Ben. Who knew what kind of weird logic he was operating under? If he did something terrible to Mara, would he have had any concept of it being wrong? He hadn't planned to kill Fett's daughter, but she hadn't survived his interrogation. Jaina hated herself for even thinking it. Jason was Han Solo's son. But every killer, every criminal, was someone's kid.
No, I don't think he'd murder Mara, Jaina said. But Ben seemed pretty rational. There's something that doesn't add up. I just hope he doesn't get too close to Jason while he's doing this investigation.
So you do think Jason would harm his own family?
Dad, he's already done plenty of harming.
What are you going to do with him? I mean, you must have something planned, or you wouldn't be going to sign up for the Fett Masterclass.
I'll bring him in, she said.
Bring him in. Then what? Deprogram him? Lock him in the attic like you're supposed to do with crazy relatives? Rehabilitate him and take him back into the Jedi Order? What happens to ex-Sith lords?
The alternative is leaving him to carry on, Dad.
Han Solo had never scared his kids, but he was scaring Jaina now. She dropped her chin slightly.
We can worry about all that after he's out of harm's way.
Okay, said Han. If I was looking for Fett, I'd go to him starting at Mandalore. He'll give you a hard time, you know that.
Whatever it takes.
He might show you the door.
Won't know until I ask.
You think your temper will hold out?
I can do anything when I really want to, Jaina said. And I want to bring Jason in before anyone else gets to him. Maybe before Ben gets too close, too. For everyone's sake.
Fett doesn't have all the moves, or he'd have killed Jason by now and wearing some part of his anatomy as a trophy.
Jason's not invincible, Dad. Nobody is. But when I go after him, it'll have to be with skills he doesn't have. Like Fett's.
If you run into problems, your mom and I are going to be looking for alternative sites for a Jedi base not too far from that part of the galaxy,
No, said Jaina. I won't need rescuing. I just wanted to know if you thought there was another way to do this.
Han didn't have a better idea, or he would have argued. He gave her a long hug instead, silent and helpless. And she knew then that the focus she'd keep in her mind when things got ugly was that she had to do this to stop her father's suffering. The general good, the trillions of beings whose lives might be at stake, was impossible to use as a powerful motivator. She needed something that would galvanize her from the gut, from the soul, and that something was her father's face, drained of the spirit that made him such a hero to her.
"Look after Mom," she said,
and walked away into the trees.
"I love you, Dad."
"Hey, don't take the stealth eggs to Mandalore," he called after her. "It'll just tick them off. And I love you too, sweetheart."
Jaina turned around a few times to check if Han was still watching or back in the refuge of the falcon. But he waited, arms folded, then waved. It must have compounded his pain to know that when things had reached their lowest ebb, his own daughter thought that the only man who could help was Fett. Fett knew what it was like to lose a kid and see his family torn apart. She hoped, for no logical reason whatsoever, that the man would agree to train her not because he wanted to have his revenge on Jason, but because he understood her pain. In the end, though, it didn't matter at all.